Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jan Schwegner. I am a professor here at CERGI and also founder and head of the Institute for Democracy and Economic Analysis IDEA think tank. I am very pleased to welcome you all and also to welcome our distinguished guests who are here on the podium.
Managed to achieve the high level of economic development that it has achieved one of the most advanced countries. Let me say just a few words for those of you who don't know. CERGI here, it's a joint workplace of Charles University. CERG stands for the Center for Economic Research and Graduate Education and is a unit of Charles University, reporting directly to the rector of Charles University. EI is the Economics Institute of the Academy of Sciences of the Czech Republic and reports to the Academy and its chairman. We're pleased to have with us Professor Michal Kejak sitting over there, who is the director of CERG and EI and the joint place, workplace CERG-EI. As part of this institution, we founded several years ago IDEA as an institution, a think tank that would take the academic and sometimes very esoteric research that we do and apply it at the level that can be useful for public policy, for economic, social policy. So we have a number of researchers, including Dr. Soholet here with us, who participate actively in this institution, and we have prepared a number of position papers that have been used by the government and international as well as other national institutions. So today we are very pleased to be able to have this seminar that actually brings together people with a variety of interests, and I am particularly pleased to introduce and pass the baton on to Mr. Marcus Alexander Antoinetti, who is the ambassador, His Excellency Ambassador of the Embassy of Switzerland here in the Czech Republic. And as I do that, on a personal note, I have particular relationship to Switzerland. When I left as a 17-year-old as a political refugee from Czechoslovakia, it was Switzerland that granted me and my family, my parents, my sister, political asylum. So my first step into the free world was in fact through Switzerland. It was wonderful. I enjoyed very much my stay there, and it was only my studies in the United States that in the end led me to take the same political asylum through the United States and become the U.S. citizen as I did, but I still come back to Switzerland very frequently, and it is my favorite place, so it's a particular pleasure to introduce this joint event with Switzerland. Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Director. I am extremely pleased to be here. As you said, you have been granted political asylum, and others in Switzerland. We took between 13,000 to 17,000 people from former Czechoslovakia, and I think it was a win-win for all of us. I am happy that you reciprocate and give us a temporary stay here in CERGI this afternoon, and it is definitely an honor for us. You know, just two words when I was thinking for this word as CERGI EI. I thought when I was a young teenager, we were watching in these old black and white TVs how the Americans were landing at the moon. And I read recently that the computer of this rocket and then finally of the moon landing, module, he had the capacity which a laptop has today. I was checking that 1 gigabyte today, it's 2 credit cards. in earlier times it was 700 square meters and they need the electricity of a little village. I think that says enough about innovation and about change. And I must tell you from my own experience in the last 31 years, I must say I was in countries which had a lot of commodities because they thought that the change comes from commodities beneath the earth, be it copper in the Congo, be it gold and diamonds in South Africa, or be it just petroleum in Venezuela. But I personally, I think that the change and innovation is not coming from commodities which are beneath our feet, but it starts 1 meter 70 above the earth, because the change and the innovation is coming from ourselves, and we have to want to do it. And it is not just a star which is there on heaven. It is together. It needs also a very good education system, and after all, it needs the will of ourselves to change and to adapt. And I would not be Swiss, because we always say, well, the good is the enemy of the better. That means usually we try to do the same. We would not like so much to change. And I will stop with a little quote from a German professor which said, innovations, they are breaking traditions. They are not natural events like earthquake, but we want to do it and we have to do it. And with this, I'm very pleased that we can have this discussion here on innovation, what we have to do and how we can exchange best practice to put it in motion. Thank you very much for your presence. Once more, thank you very much, Director, for being here. It is for us an honor working with you together, and I hope we will have a very interesting discussion this afternoon. Thank you.
I will now introduce the moderator of the event. Many of you know him, Dr. Daniel Munich is a professor here at CERJI. He is a frequent contributor to the scene, the discussion of educational and macroeconomic issues in general in the Czech Republic, in Europe, in the world. And he will be introducing the speakers and moderating the discussion today. Daniel, why don't you come take this place here?
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My life is much easier because Jan introduced me already, so I can quickly step to other pieces of information. First, I will briefly inform you about the intended program today. So the whole event will be held in English, but we have translator services, so if there are questions in Czech, we can deal with them, but you will need, those who do not speak Czech will need headphones which are available there and here, and we will manage that. Next, today's event will have two parts. In the first half, we'll have presentations which are intended to motivate, to provide ideas, thoughts for food. Then we'll have short break to change labels here and change presentations, and have another group of distinguished people who know a lot about the topic, about the current Czech situation, who will be expected to provide us challenging feedback on how to use the information we get from the initial presentations here. And it will be time for you to raise questions, comments, and so on. So, this is the plan, and I will step quickly to introduce our speakers in the first half. So, first I will introduce Ivan Levkovic, who is sitting on my right-hand side. I have to say that I will be very brief presenting people, because would I tell you all these their accomplishments, we would have to have another seminar, another day. So, Ivan Levkovic is founding member of the Basel Institute for Immunology, where he is a member for 33 years. At present, he is at the University Hospital in Basel, former chairman of the Central European Summer School of Immunology during early 90s, and honorary member of the Learned Society of the Czech Republic. I will introduce everybody and then we will start presentations. Then, next to him is Alexander Lucas Bieri. Again, long CV, so let me mention that he is with Roche Group Holdings since 1994, and in 2000 he was appointed to the position of curator of the Roche Historical Collection and Archive, and he also assumed the responsibility for the architectural heritage of Roche. He has published many books and articles and many other things, and we really await his presentation here. Next to me is Martin Cerholetz, who is from CERJ. He is colleague of mine, also academician, not native moderator, as I am not. His task is also important because he will put the Swiss experience into the Czech environment, Czech current environment, so that we better understand the questions we are dealing with. Martin got his PhD in Norway, and I forgot, Oslo University, right? And currently he has partly position here at CERJ, where he deals with research on research, especially on innovations, and partial appointment in at the University of Lund in Sweden. So, I was introduced too, so probably it's time to start with the first presentation by Alexander Bieri on structural permeability as a key factor in Switzerland's innovation success story. So in a few seconds, we will manage to change the presentation and we'll start and we'll probably turn off the major light so that you can see the projections.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, is this on?
It's not.
It's not.
Turn it on. Let me. No, this big green one which looks like nothing.
Yeah, thank you. Excellent. The vagaries of technology. That's so much about innovation. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming in such a great number to my presentation on the innovation success story of Switzerland. I would like to start with a remark about Switzerland as a country. An English commentator once remarked that Switzerland's economic success is very much like the bumblebee flying. As you probably know, the bumblebee, physically, or from what you know about physics, is actually incapable of flying, or should be incapable of flying. Nevertheless, it does fly, and it is very successful at flying, and nobody really understands why. And very much the same is true for Switzerland and its economic success. Imagine a landlocked country, a country which is very mountainous. It's very expensive to produce crop, to produce food there. It's also a country which has no natural resources whatsoever, no iron ore, no oil, no gas, no silver, no gold. The only natural resource which Switzerland has is hydroelectricity. And indeed, Switzerland used to be a very poor country, which might come as a surprise to some of you who know Switzerland from today's time. Switzerland also has a very twisted story about how it developed and how it came to happen. And we have to dig a little bit into the history of the country in order to understand why it has become so productive in terms of innovation. Now, if we take patents as a grade for innovation, Switzerland per capita, patents per capita every year, is at the helm of the world's innovation. And it's very interesting to tap into the history of the country to understand why this has happened and which facilitators there were which made this success possible. Now, In 1460, the oldest university in today's Switzerland, the University of Basel, was founded, followed in 1559 by the foundation of the Université de Genève. However, one has to realize, of course, that these cantons are at the border of Switzerland and that they have a success story and a development story all of their own. Switzerland was by no means a state, a central state, like it is today at the time. It was more a conglomeration of loosely knit together cantons, a group of shared interests, so to speak, in between these cantons, which all were sovereign states. In 1798, Napoleon thought that Switzerland would be ripe for the revolution, very much French-style revolution, and he came to Switzerland and pronounced the Helvetic Republic. The Helvetic Republic was put in place, and for the first time, these cantons, which formerly were just a very loosely knit together group of interested parties, so to speak, had something like a central government. And in Switzerland, of course, there were very progressive, enlightened people also in the cantons, specifically bordering France, Germany, and Austria. And they already had the idea of creating a centralized state because they realized that the new developments of the Industrial Revolution could only be put to fruitful use if there would be some kind of central administration within this strange conglomerate that was old Switzerland. Well, 1803, the Helvetic Republic already was dissolved, and the more conservative people in Switzerland and more conservative cantons had their way. There was a period of restoration and regeneration, which was very complicated, very twisted, a strange time, not only in Switzerland, but in all of Europe, actually. And this resulted in 1847 in a civil war, in the so-called Sonderbundskrieg, in a civil war which pitted the more progressive cantons in Switzerland against the more conservative cantons, who wanted to retain the old structure. And I'm just switching forward to the next slide in order to show you what happened during this civil war, during the Sonderbund War in 1847. The yellow cantons are the conservative cantons who opposed the centralization of the government in Switzerland. The green cantons are the progressive cantons who favored centralized government, who were in favor of the new ideas, the novel ideas. It's also, but more by accident, that the yellow cantons were mostly Catholic and the green cantons were mostly Protestant. So it was also, to some extent, a religious war, interestingly enough. If we switch back to the former slide, we see that in 1848 also some European revolutions broke out, for example in Germany, as you might know. And on the 12th September, finally the progressive cantons won. They won over the Catholic cantons, and it meant that modern Switzerland could be founded, the Confederatio Helvetica, as we know it today, as a centrally guided federalist confederation of individual cantons. Now, it's very interesting to see this story and to read this story, because as it was the case in the 19th century, they sought a way to integrate all parties, all warfaring parties in Switzerland, the conservatives and also the progressive ones, into this new state. So a mythology had to be found, a foundation mythology of Switzerland with which everybody could live, and they couldn't just say, well, we've won over you, and therefore we now have to say, the more progressive cantons. So they got the idea, or they came to the idea of taking 1201 as an official founding date for Switzerland, which was not really the case, actually. It's very much based on mythology, this date. And actually, the modern Switzerland, as we know it today, was founded only in 1848. Now, what happened is that this young state financed itself through the cantons. So the new central government, which was set up in Bern, which today is seen as a sort of capital of Switzerland, but it's just a seat of the federal government, it doesn't have official status as a capital until this very day, which is very much because of the Sonderbund War and because they wanted to avoid all notion of having one over the other cantons. The central government financed itself fully from contributions from the cantons at first. They didn't levy any taxes directly. And this was so much money which poured in, but they really didn't know what to do with it. They swam in money, really, literally, and it was very unclear what to do with all this wealth which suddenly poured into the central government, which was still very small at the time. So one idea which was developed was to create a central university for Switzerland, which was strongly opposed by the two university cantons, Basel and Geneva, who already had canton universities, which were strongly established. But in the end, what was done with the money is the Swiss Federal Institute for Technology was founded in 1854 as one use for the surplus money which was available from the central state. And the mission of the ETH, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, explicitly was to educate engineers and scientists, to serve as a national center of excellence in science and technology, and to provide a hub for interaction between the scientific community and the industry. Now, this is a very far-reaching charter which was set up for the ETH at a very early time, and something very interesting indeed at that time. And it was also tasked specifically with the training of specialists for industry and trade, which is also something which was included into the charter of the ETH right from the start and which is quite remarkable. Now, because there was this revolution in Germany, the ETH could be staffed with professors from Germany. They sought to evade their terrible situation they were in sometimes in Germany, and so they gladly came to Switzerland, which was already relatively stable compared to the rest of Europe. And the steering committees of the ETH also were regularly staffed with people from the industry. I'll come to that later on. But the ETH board, until this very day, is organized like a parliament. It contains people from academia, it contains people from the industry boards, and it also contains people, of course, from the government, and they all decide together on the strategy of the ETH. Also something quite remarkable. In 1952, and I'll mention that later on more in detail, another institution was established, the Swiss National Science Foundation. It was created by the initiative of Alexander von Murald, the physicist from Switzerland, who saw that there was a great need for interdisciplinary work, for interdisciplinary research in Switzerland across the borders of single institutions. And the Swiss National Science Foundation was set up as a financing body in order to enable these kind of interdisciplinary and multi-institutional projects. Now, the special thing about the ETH really is that it's a government-sponsored, a government-financed institution. It has, of course, governing bodies like the ETH board, which I already mentioned, but there are also single professors and institutes. And throughout its history, the ETH took money directly from companies, for example, to certain institutes, companies which were interested in the work which was done in certain institutes of the ETH, basic research work, for example, which companies found interesting for their own later development work, was financed directly by the companies. But also, of course, there are industry representations which could take a seat in the governing bodies of the ETH and thus decide on what kind of course the ETH would take strategically and what kind of new subjects, for example, would be introduced or what kind of new research fields would be introduced into the long-term strategy of the ETH. As I told you before, the ETH board, this governing body of the ETH, can be very much seen like a representative parliament stuffed with academia, with people from the government and with people from the industry and also the industry representations, because the ETH also has the task to educate people for the industry. So also companies, of course, influence the industry representation, which then sits in the ETH. They influence the governing bodies directly. Sometimes people from the industry are also sent directly to the ETH board. This happens. And of course, the companies also influence foundations and foundation-based financing of projects in the ETH. Now, the National Science Foundation, which was set up in 1952, as I told you, very much on the initiative of one man, Alexander von Murald, today has a budget approximating 800 million to 1 billion Swiss francs. And also in the Swiss National Science Foundation, we have a foundation council, which is organized very much like the board of the ETH, like a representative parliament, stuffed with people from scientific organizations, from the Rector's Conference of the Swiss Universities of Applied Sciences, with representatives of the Swiss Conference of Rectors, Universities of Teachers, and also with members elected by the Federal Council, by the Parliament. They elect and supervise the Research Council, which is focusing on the research programs like humanities and social sciences, mathematics, natural and engineering sciences, and biology and medicine programs. And there are three specialized committees which are responsible for cross-divisional matters like international cooperation, careers, and interdisciplinary research. And the aim of the Swiss National Science Foundation really is to foster multi-institutional interdisciplinary research within Switzerland. So these are two very important steps, two very important steps in making Switzerland the innovation hub it is today. Now, before we dive in detail into the timeline of the development of the Swiss innovation landscape, let's first also have a look at what we understand under basic research and applied research, because this will be quite important in my further presentation. There are many different ways to describe what innovation actually means. But I found Josef Schumpeter's way of describing it always the most useful. He once said, the creation and commercialization of differentiated products and services which lead to a tangible improvement to human life, this is innovation essentially for us. And of course, this phrase contains two words, creation and commercialization. And under creation, we understand, in contrast to mere production, creation also encompasses an artistic or spiritual aspect. It is not really planable. And that's one of the reasons why basic research takes place essentially in government-sponsored institutions and also in academia, in teaching, because there are vast resources there, all these doctoral studies which are written, doctoral theses, where a huge number of people tackle a huge number of different problems and thus find new kind of ways of thinking, new kind of ways of seeing problems in science, and can create what we understand on the basic research. In contrast to that, innovation, the commercialization, is the dispersion of a technical or administrative novelty. It can be planned, and so this is best left to companies and company-affiliated institutions, which have a shorter-range planning horizon, which also allows them to cater for the fast dissemination and interspersion of these technical novelties which were found out in basic research. So these are two quite good ways of describing what we understand on the basic research and applied research. And I also would like to mention two countries which have gone a slightly different way. For example, Germany. In Germany, after the Second World War, the Germans still very much stuck to the idea that basic research in universities has to remain independent of companies. This was a movement after the Second World War which generally took place all over the world. Universities wanted to break the ties with the governments, with the companies, with the economy which they had before the Second World War. They wanted to become independent, and they sought this independence also by breaking the old ties they had to the companies. Also, the problems with the company-sponsored military complex and the company and the industrial military complex, of course, as Eisenhower has described it, might have played a role in this development that the universities sought independence from economy. Now, in Germany, this is still to some extent the case today, because they started much later than other countries introducing closer ties in between university, academia, and economy. And one case study, what happens with a country which goes that way, is the MP3 format, which, as you might know, was invented by the Fraunhofer Institute in Germany. But there was nobody in Germany, or there were no ties from the Fraunhofer Institute into a company which actually could do something with the MP3 format. It was then a Californian company, Apple, which produced the first MP3 player, and one could state that from the MP3 player, the smartphone, the iPhone, developed. So it's a huge business, but the business was not made in Germany, where the MP3 format originally was invented. And that's quite a good case of what happens if the link in between applied research and basic research does not work well. Another case study would be pharma research in the United Kingdom. Now, as you probably know, the United Kingdom has been a hub for pharmaceutical research throughout the 20th century. And during the Thatcher years, during the Thatcher reforms, universities were more and more twisted and tweaked to do applied research and to focus on applied research. Research which would contribute quickly to the bottom line of the country and to the gross domestic product. And they were actually encouraged to leave basic research aside. And the problem, of course, there is that Britain as a place for pharmaceutical research became less and less attractive for foreign countries. For example, Roche shut down their research center in the United Kingdom already in the 1990s because there were no novel ideas coming from universities in basic research which could be taken up. A company always wants to diversify its research activities throughout the world to profit from all kind of different mindsets. This is the reason why Western pharmaceutical companies set up research bases, for example, China. We want to profit from the different mindset people have there, from the different approach they take to research problems. And the last victim to this policy in the United Kingdom was the huge research center of Pfizer in Sandwich. Pfizer closed down the research center in Sandwich, which caused a job loss in a very highly highly qualified sector with researchers and academia of 9,000, which was a huge blow to the research scene in the United Kingdom. So this is another case study. We have two quite extreme cases there which show what happens when a country focuses on one track, on applied research or on basic research, and misses out on combining both. Let's return to Switzerland before 1850. Before 1850, we very much had the situation that there was a very limited basic research in universities, mainly in Basel, Geneva, and to a very little extent in Zurich, which was more or less only theology. And of course, they sent some people to the industry, and there was some application of research also done in the industry, but not very much. The research-based industry in Switzerland before 1850 was very, very small. It didn't really exist, actually. And as I told you, it was a very poor immigration country still at the time. Now, with the ETH and the applied research done in the ETH, strong ties were established in between the industry, and the industry immediately saw the potential for an exchange with the academia, which was set up in the ETH. Also, the German professors, which in their universities in Germany had worked together already with companies, came with their experiences to Switzerland, and this fostered an exchange in between industry and the ETH, which was very important for the development of Switzerland as an industrial nation. The universities, of course, saw that there was something happening, a competition starting to take place in Switzerland, and they also started to conduct extensive basic research and tried to establish some exchange with the industry, or better said, vice versa. The industry tried to start some exchange with the universities, but this was still very feeble compared to the ETH. After 1952, the National Science Fund was put in place, and this meant that suddenly there was an institution in place which actually spanned the ETH and the old universities. And suddenly the thinking the multi-institutional thinking, which already to some extent was in place in the ETH, which was very varied in terms of its research projects, started to infect, so to speak, the traditional universities. And thanks to the Science Foundation, the universities became much more aware of the importance of applied research to put the research results also into practice. Now, as I told you before, in the case of Germany, after the Second World War, there was quite a readiness in the academia to work together with industry. People in academia did not like the industry very much, and they tried to be as independent as possible from the companies, from the industry, from economy. And so the influence of the industry on the teaching programs waned temporarily, and the industry, of course, had to react, because the industry tried to conduct some basic research itself, but as I explained to you before, the industry is very badly suited for conducting basic research. Basic research programs take a lot of time, which the industry usually doesn't have. They don't have the money which they can invest for decades into research projects which may or may not yield results. But under the pressure of this situation, the industry had to react. And one good example in case is the biosciences in the 1960s. Also in the universities in Switzerland and in many other countries, the classic chemistry, the classic synthetic chemistry, was in a very strong position after the Second World War. And the new biosciences, which sprung up all over the world, had a very hard time competing against the synthetic chemistry. Also, in companies like Roche, there was a battle in between the young new biochemists which came into the company and the old established chemists of the synthetic chemistry field. The industry, the companies realized that there is something happening out there which would be interesting, especially for pharmaceuticals, and they couldn't tap into the universities and into academia, because the universities were trying to shield themselves off from money from the companies, from the economy essentially. And so what the companies resorted to is that they created industry financed specialized research institutes which tried to tap into the universities, and also in the case of Switzerland into the ETH. The people in academia saw the people working in these industry-financed specialized basic research institutes as their colleagues. It was like working together with another state-funded or state-sponsored independent research institute. And often they didn't even realize that they were actually 100% financed by the industry. So this was a completely new type of institute. And I told you how long it takes, or how long it can take, and how much money a company has to invest when it comes to bringing basic research results to fruition. And one example is Roche, of course, which I have a good overview of, and which I brought to you today. We have here a photograph of the foundation of the Roche Institute of Molecular Biology. It was one of two independent research institutes set up by Roche in the 1960s. This photograph was taken in 1968, and if you read what's written in the showcase here, below the hands of the gentleman here who actually founded the institute right at that moment, it is quite interesting, because in the first phrase it says hereditary information coded into DNA in chromosomes, and then carrying the blueprint, and then manufacturing the essential components of life. So this was a grand vision for the future, which they set out in 1968 to make it possible, essentially. But what does this mean for a company like Roche? What does this mean in investment terms? It meant that, first of all, in 1968, these two institutes, the Roche Institute for Molecular Biology and the Basel Institute for Immunology, were set up and staffed. Then in 1972, at the Roche Institute for Molecular Biology, Sidney Pescar for the first time isolated human interferon. In 1975, Niels Jerne and his team at the BII developed a method for the production of monoclonal antibodies. In 1977, Roche started a collaboration with the founders of Genentech in San Francisco to establish the production for interferon alpha, the product which was isolated by Sidney Pescar a couple of years before at the RIMP. in 1981, Roche could launch a first commercial product which was based on monoclonal antibodies. It was a cancer test. It didn't bring very much money. And every year, millions and millions and millions were invested into these independent research institutes. In 1984, Niels Hierne, Georges Köhler, and César Milstein were awarded the Nobel Prize for their method for the production of monoclonal antibodies. In 1986, the first biotechnologically produced drug of Roche, Rovron A, was launched, thanks to the help of Genentech. 1989, Roche took over a majority of the shares of Genentech because they worked on products called monoclonal antibodies, which the company found interesting. And in 1997, MabThera was launched, the first cancer drug based on monoclonal antibodies, which ushered in a completely new era in the treatment of cancer, and which is mainly responsible for all the successes we have seen in the past decades in cancer treatment. But as you can see, from 1968, to 1997, decades and decades and decades passed of continuous investments into this technology until it bore fruits. And that's the reason why companies usually are in no position to conduct basic research and why basic research has to be state-run and state-funded. Company like Roche, which focuses on research and which focuses on very highly priced novel drugs and innovative drugs, is in a position to invest a lot of money into research. We invest about a fifth of our total turnover in research every year, but still I would question whether the company would be in a place or in a position to invest into such a process today. It was a different time in the 1960s. Profit margins actually were even much higher in the pharmaceutical industry than they are now, and so I would question very much that something like that would be possible today in a company. But nevertheless, some of these institutes have survived. For example, our competitors in Basel, Novartis, they still operate the Friedrich Miescher Institute. And at the same time, the universities have copied these institutes because it turned out that they are very successful at creating new specialties. So that's the green field. And of course, we also have spin-offs of universities because the universities have also realized how important applied research is and how important it is to bring their novel ideas and their innovations in basic research into commercial products. And so the university have resorted to take venture capital and also to provide venture capital and to foster people who have interesting, innovative ideas to create spin-offs from the universities. And there are also spin-offs, of course, of the large companies in novel fields. What we have here is more or less the innovation landscape in Switzerland today. And my talk is titled Structural Permeability as a Key Factor in Switzerland's Innovation Success Story. It is exactly this varied landscape of different kind of institutions, of different kind of methods to collaborate in between these institutions and economy, which makes Switzerland so successful. And as you have seen, it is built up very much on the idea of taking as many deciding bodies as possible into the large two institutions which actually have been vital and I would say pivotal, have played a pivotal role in creating out of Switzerland, out of this agrarian country, the innovation powerhouse it is today. So as you can see, I've taken you very quickly through quite a long stretch, an interesting stretch of Swiss history. I hope that you found my explanations interesting and insightful, and I'm looking forward to an interesting discussion later on. Thank you very much indeed for your attention.
Thank you very much indeed. So we'll continue with a presentation by Ivan Levkovits, who will tell us a little bit about Nobel Prizes and returns to investments and so on. I will help you with the presentation.
In the meantime, I start already.
No,
thank you very much. And
How do I?
Is this?
Um weiter zu. Damit kann man weiter schieben. Ja. Okay, gut, danke. I'm extremely grateful to the organizers of this event, especially to the Swiss Embassy, and within the Swiss Embassy to Mr. Ambassador and to Mrs. Sonja Kritzlerová, who made this very special event, and I'm very happy to be here with you. I asked earlier some of our colleagues whether, in fact, they or we know where we are in this beautiful building. And some of those people know, some not, and some know it by name, Shebek Palais, Shepkov Palace, and some people don't know who was Shebek. And I'm not going to the details, we can discuss it during the cocktail, but it was built for Mr. Shebek, and the great, great grandson of Mr. Shebek is with us here in this room. His name is Bernard Schafarzik, who is a Swiss filmmaker and Swiss director. Some of his films you might know, some not, but the connection should be said, since we all know that if we don't know where are we coming from, we don't know where are we going to. So that is about the place where this takes place. Besides that, I would like to mention that we have here some other Swiss people. One of them is Professor Ansorge from Lausanne, formerly from Heidelberg, who contributed quite a bit to that where today's genome sequencing in a modern way is done. And in fact, the net results of his effort made the possibility that he settled in Switzerland. I'm not so sure whether he would do so otherwise. Now, during a few minutes, I will take you through a story. And this story is a success story, and it's not based on commerce, it's based on the effort which had to do only and only with basic research, but by pure chance it ended up in something which is now a multi-billion dollar business worldwide and is bringing to Roche a considerable part of their net profit. We go very fast through the slides. And my intention is to tell you, first of all, at the lower right part of the slide, you see four pharmaceutical companies, Roche, Ciba, Geigy, Sandoz. It was in 1969. Basic research was done at that time only at the University of Basel and was supported by Swiss National Fund, as Mr. Bieri explained. And in that 1969, again, you watch the upper right corner of where the date is given, one of this company, Roche, decided to invest extra money in basic research. This small blue circle means that little bit of money which is given to the basic research. The institute, the arrow shows from Roche, who did it, and the BII stands for Basel Institute for Immunology. At very soon, now at the upper right corner you see 1971, very soon Ciba and Geigy fused to create a new company which is called Ciba Geigy. So the BII had the Roche was made by BII, and the FMI, which is Friedrich Miescher Institute, was created by Sibagaigi. And besides that, another institute was founded, which is Biozentrum, which is financed the basic buildings and everything around it was done by pharmaceutical company, and money came by basically by Swiss from Swiss National Fund. And in 1976, where I am now making a jump, but I will still return back to 70, 71. But in 76, the everything remained as in the previous slide, except of that, that still a new institution was created, which was called Zentrum für Lehre und Forschung. And that was financed by a number of pharmaceutical companies, and they get money also from Swiss National Fund, just to see the enrichment of that surrounding. Now, I come back to the BII, Basel Institute for Immunology. It was founded in 1969. The founding director was Niels Jerne, as mentioned by Alexander Bieri. Years later, decades later, receiving Nobel Prize together with George Köhler and with Cesar Milstein. And the institute was at that time called a small, big institute, because it had 150 people. At that time, it was quite a sizable range, range of scientists working there. But it was organized in a special way, and I will not have enough time to go into it, but at least to mention 50 scientists, 50 technicians, 50 personnel, 10 permanent members, and a rotation of 2 to 3 years contract, no bosses, free academic atmosphere. It was done by Hoffmann LaRoche. This blue and yellow portion, that is the entire amount of money which Roche is putting into research. The major part, of course, in R&D, research and development, viscum avivoi. And the yellow portion is that what was reserved for the basic research. And and now I'm showing only, I cut out the blue portion, the big one, because I'm not going to talk about R&D. I'm going to talk about basic research. It had an enormously generous budget with free choice of projects, no string attached. The only thing was that the patents should or did belong or was supposed to belong to the mother company, that is to Roche. In German, one says, über Geld spricht man nicht, Geld hat man. And this was the case for our institute indeed. We had an enormously generous budget, for most purposes, I would say unlimited budget, but there was a number, and it was about 30 million Swiss francs per year. Try to multiply it by 20 or 25, and what could you accommodate here in this country? It was a lot of money for 50 scientists. So, and instead of a monolithic approach where there would be one team to solve, instead of that, the 50 scientists had 50 independent research projects, or certain people worked together, so maybe a little bit less than 50, but a large number of research projects. There was a common theme, and that was antibody specificity. But the blue part meant how some people thought should be done, one single big project working in one single direction, while the right part shows the Basler Fasnacht confetti, showing that it's an unlimited diversification of projects. Now, that was, if I go back, 71. 73, if you are able to read the table, it's only 2 or 3 years, and the institute just bubbled with activity. And as you can see, in Basel Institute was on the second place, almost sharing with University of Zurich, together, let's say separately, Basel Institute, 14% of all papers cited in Switzerland were from our institute. And indeed, if you look a little bit lower, Hoffmann La Roche with a number of people 10 times, 100 times as many as our institute, their share was only 4.5%. We were very proud of the achieved things. Was not planned. It happened because Jerne, when he founded the institute, he said, I want the best people available. Point is the best people available, not the best people, because if you have the best people and they are not available, you cannot do science with them. So he had to have the best people available, and Hoffmann La Roche was willing to pay for it, and they did, and the result was that what followed, because we contributed a lot into the knowledge of the knowledge base which developed throughout the world, and the turnover of scientists guaranteed that people moved to prestigious places, and now they are among several hundred different places. This is our turnover table, how scientists moved from place to place, filling the entire world of science due to these 2 or 3 years contracts. It's 1976, and something happened which was not planned. Monoclonal antibody was discovered 8 years later, Nobel Prize is mentioned, and it will be mentioned. But on the right yellow circle, you see this Y-shaped thing, which is the Y, which is the Y, which you can see on my coat.
So it's not secret police, no.
And it's the highest Czechoslovak recognition for immunologists. About 6 or 7 people have it, some of them here in the room. But I have attached it because of the shape of that thing, but that will be coming in the third slide from here. The question is now, and you please ask yourself the question. So there is an institute and discovers how to make monoclonal antibody. I will tell you what it is, the monoclonal antibody. But before, is the question is going to be a very big discovery bringing billions. What to do? Expand the research towards monoclonal antibody in that institute and to make billions of dollars or whatever? The answer is no, because it could occur only, this expansion could occur only upon diminishing other research activities. Monoclonal antibody would bring a lot of money but would destroy the institute. So the solution is to transfer the development to the mother company, to Roche, which we did, with all kind of up and downs, which I'm not going into it now. The word up and downs can be very, very well interpreted by Mr. Bieri. But now I want to give you 1 minute science. on the left side is antibody, is this thing. This is a complex molecule made of several hundred different antibodies. There are four chains of antibodies. And one single cell, which is now can be shown, how do you make the laser point here?
Yes, no, the red one.
The red one. Excuse me. So this is a cell. It's a lymphocyte. This lymphocyte makes this antibody. The cell is capable of making 100,000 molecules per second of this molecule. Now one can have. And the size of this is enormously large as a polypeptide. In Dalton, it's 1 million Daltons. But still, the number is much less than it. One pixel of on this. The size is much less of this molecule than one pixel on this picture. So now we continue. 8 years passed, Nobel Prize 1984 for Niels Jerne and George Köhler, and Roche started to make enormous use of this invention. The monoclonal antibody was not patented, and then 3 years later another Nobel Prize came to our institute, to Susumu Tonegawa, an ingenious Japanese scientist who did not share the prize with anybody when he was young, and he came to our institute. He says, I won the Nobel Prize and I'm not going to share it with anybody, and he succeeded to get it. So that was 1987 Nobel Prize, and now we slowly come to end by recapitulating. So the pharmaceutical company starts an institute. Basic knowledge is acquired and now starts work without knowing whether it will be financially and innovation-mindedly successful, but it was. It brought to our institute fame, success, Nobel Prize, and it was a side product of our activity, was the monoclonal antibody, which made all these billions. And the company's main revenue now, the Roche main revenue now, is from monoclonal antibody. Is it so?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. So, and now it comes again, 30-second science. Everything which happens in our body is based on a certain biochemical pathway of events. If in that pathway you identify any molecule which is of interest for you, you say, I identified a biomarker. So you know a certain position in the pathway which is of interest for you. If you have this marker, you might have a target which attaches to this to this biomarker. And if you have the target, and then you might be able, it's not sure, but it's very probably you can, if you invest the money, make monoclonal antibody which has this specific site at the end of the Y, at the end of this epsilon, which is going to attach to that place, and you have a medicament. So I come back to this slide. I want to say the following, that Hoffmann La Roche has a strategy which includes monoclonal antibody. At their yearly meeting at the General Assembly, they mention the Basel Institute for Immunology, in spite of the fact, I come back to this, that in, that by now the situation is the following. Might be a surprise for you, but the Siba Geigy and Sandoz fused, you have Novartis now, so the entire big scheme of four pharmaceutical companies came down to two companies, Roche and Novartis. All these other companies were, other small institutes were maintained, and Hoffmann La Roche had shut down Basel Institute for Immunology, and it terminated it, and it still keeps saying, and in Roche parlance it means that it BII fulfilled its function, and Roche is very proud of its achievements. Let's start to do now something else. And this is, of course, the right of the company to do so, but here, if we go now to these five major products which Hoffmann La Roche has, Herceptin, Katsila, Avastin, Perjeta, Maptera. Maptera was mentioned by Mr. Bieri. I hope you will never need any of these medicaments, but you at least should know that these companies have a second name, and interestingly enough, the last three letters of that name is MAB, trastuzumab, bevacizumab, pertuzumab, rituximab, and MAB means monoclonal antibody. So all this is based on the results of things happening in our institute. And my private take-home lesson, which you might want to pick up anything you want from it in your discussion, is that industry is supposed to support industrial research, industry is supposed to support basic research, and industry should not try to get support from the state, but quite opposite. Basic research is supported both by industry and by the state budgets. And the last one, without basic research, industry stagnates. That's all what I wanted to tell you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lefkowitz. And because we are a little bit lagging in time, behind time, I will ask Martin Cihulec. He will bring us to the Czech environment, so we'll start confronting the Swiss experience. I think Martin is ready to start.
Yes, thank you. As Dan already said, I'm based here in Prague. 1 feet, another feet is in University of Lund in Sweden. But I also survived 8 long Norwegian winters. So this gives me a very particular Scandinavian look on the southern Czech innovation system. And I will use some of that. Innovation system, that was word that is actually in the title of today's seminar. It hasn't been mentioned by the previous speakers, and some of you might not be familiar with the concept. So I will spend very quickly 2 minutes by previewing what innovation system means and the lessons from this line of research. Here you can see some of the definitions. There is not one accepted definition in the literature, as sometimes is with concepts, and there are many discussions and fights between the main protagonists, but you are welcome to read that. You will get the basic taste. This concept emerged in the late 80s at the interface between public policy and academic research. It became quite popular in the 90s. Some might say that it peaked in the previous decade. Now there are some controversies some attack the concept. Every concept has a life cycle, right? So the jury is still out whether something else will replace innovation system approach or not. But I believe it's fruitful. There are at least three lessons that will stand the test of time. First is, and that was also apparent from the definitions, that it's very actually difficult to delineate the borders of a system of innovation. When we start thinking about innovation, it very quickly expands into culture, entrepreneurship culture, essential for conversation of knowledge, bringing to market. So very difficult to draw the exact border. Some approaches are very narrow, looking only at the R&D system. Some approaches expand into educational systems, and then you expand into economy, and then you basically end with all-encompassing view. This is, of course, very difficult for economists to deal with, because we really much like clear definitions, put things into boxes, draw relationships, and then have a linear model that we estimate, if possible linear, and to get very clear input, output, sort of production function relationships. Innovation can be reduced to that, but there are costs to doing that. It resists to some extent being very clearly defined and delimited. When you hear people using this concept, it's really important to clarify what do they mean, where do you draw the border of the innovation system. Second point is, and I very much like this, it's that innovation is result of interactive learning. Maybe in some prehistoric industrial times, innovation could be developed by individuals somewhere in garage doing everything internally, or by firms doing internally all the technology. But increasingly, they need to interact with outside world. They need to interact with their consumers. They interact with their suppliers along the value chain. They sometimes interact with their competitors. But of course, they also interact with the public sector, where the fundamental knowledge is, there is a repository of fundamental knowledge where it's created with government institutes, university sector. And this is important to take note that innovation seldom comes from only internal capabilities of the firms. Firms need to interact and use outside knowledge. Third point is that the market failures are important in innovation, but it's not the full story. There are also system failures, and the policy has to focus on both, because focusing only on market failures, that would miss big part of the picture. Many of transactions, if you want, that happen in innovation system don't go through market. They are in pre-market phase, or they are under hierarchies, or in a hybrid organizational forms. So there is partly market, but there is also a system that can fail and fail to deliver. So then in policy, it's important not to use the market failure only argument, but also look at the system and if it fails in what it's supposed to do. So much for, and I will come back to some of these points throughout the presentation. So much for the great theory, Switzerland and Czech Republic. So similar, almost difficult. It's so easy to confuse, right? I'm sorry for the quality of this picture, but I believe me, it's no fake. I remember vaguely seeing it on my own eyes. What are the similarities, Czech Republic and Switzerland? Why could anybody confuse? Landlocked, we heard that already, right? Northern Hemisphere, right? What else? Yeah, there are more differences than similarities, right? But But that's good for us, because if we are all the same, there will be little to learn from each other. So the point of my presentation would be to look at these differences and try to gain something for the Czech context. Here are the differences in the policy mix when it comes to innovation. I hope you can read some of the labels, but that's not the point. The point is the big picture. This is overview done by Ernst & Young. They do it for many countries. They scan the innovation policies and the subsidies. Thank you. That are available. And if you look at the big picture, you see that there is very little overlap. The Switzerland, the Czech Republic, this looks like a mirror picture. Out of these 18 checkboxes, there's only one that is implemented in both countries, that is tax holidays on R&D. We can debate the individual checkboxes. Maybe it's 1 year old, so things could change. But the big picture is that there are actually quite stunningly different approaches to innovation policy in both countries. And footnote, in Czech Republic, most of these policies are applied at the national level. In Switzerland, many of these are at the canton level, which is another striking difference. This is a quote from Eravac country report of Switzerland. One stunning, to me, as a Czech observer, characteristic of the Swiss system is that there is almost no money from the government budget going straight into subsidizing firms. There are very little cash grants to firms. Only 1% of business R&D is subsidized by government funding in Switzerland. If you then look as it's the lowest among OECD countries. If you would look at actually those figures and the comparison, that would be this figure. This is boring statistics. It's direct government funding for business R&D and also tax incentives. So not only direct grants, but also tax incentives through tax deductions and tax that is not paid by the firms. It's in 2012, or the most recent year, and it's in a percentage of total business spending. If you are familiar with the Czech discussion, you would recognize that this is a figure that is very much discussed in the Czech context. The comparison here is clear. Switzerland is at the bottom, about 1% only of business R&D funded by the government. And then there's a long line of countries. Czech Republic is not first in the world, but is in the upper part of the figure. What is also interesting is, in this comparison, that it's not based only on the direct. On the direct funding, but also indirect funding. So it's both. This is important because, as you see, in many countries, the indirect tax incentives are quite important and are actually majority of funds. So it's fair to include both if you want to make a comparison in this respect. In Switzerland, it might be underestimated because some of this canton level funding might not be accounted, and some of the tax incentive might not be accounted, but I doubt that the figure would more than double. So maybe Switzerland is on par with Finland, but it probably wouldn't move very much to the top. That's a quite strong difference with the Czech Republic. We see other developed countries around Czech Republic in the neighborhood. We see Netherlands, Belgium, France is even higher. So this is not to say that this is the only model to follow. We would very much like to have an innovation system compared to Netherlands or similar to Belgium. But it's important to know that there is also other way. This is not the only way, but there are alternatives in policy making. And it's not only Switzerland here, it's also Israel that is often given as example in Czech Republic, there's also Sweden, there's Germany, of course. So there is other way it is part of the figure. One point that deserves to be mentioned is that what really matters is what do we do with this money? How do we spend it? How do we use it? And so far, there hasn't been one single evaluation of the national programs of R&D in the business sector that would meet international standard of how evaluation should be done. So when we compare to Netherlands here, just next to it, there's a big difference in this. They really know what do they spend it from, and what are the impacts, and where it leads to. In Czech Republic, we have no idea at this point. It can be fine, but we don't know. It's the denominator is business spending on R&D, which is really big in Switzerland, so it might not be that fair to use that as denominator. If we use GDP, the figure changed, but not really dramatically. Switzerland is still among at the bottom, Czech Republic moves a little bit, but the big picture remains the same. So what are the instruments of innovation policy in Switzerland, actually, if it's not cash money for firms for R&D? Well, there are many possibilities. This is a range of some of programs run by Swiss Innovation Promotion Agency, which is Swiss equivalent to Technology Agency of the Czech Republic. And you can read through the examples. They are startup grants that train entrepreneurs. They are grants that promote networking, events for startups to exchange information and knowledge. There's a program called Innovation Mentors, which involves contact person that try to bridge, hook firms with public sector institutions. And there's also a big program of national thematic networks, which is kind of similar to Competence Centers of Czech Toucher. But interesting feature of this program is, and now we refer to the European Commission, is that there is no financial support actually granted to the firms in this program. The money goes to the public sector institutes, the firms co-fund, and access services and infrastructure, which confirms the figure. So there is a lot of going on, but it's through different means that handing cash to the firms. And most of these programs are focused on small and medium-sized enterprises. That's also important to note. It shouldn't be interpreted as a direct criticism of Toucher, because I sense that they would love to implement many of these schemes, but they are dependent on the users of the programs. And if there is not policy demand for those in the Czech Republic, it's hard to blame Toucher for not running those programs. Maybe Mr. Janeček could confirm that. There is demand for other means than typically those in the Czech Republic. When we look at the amount of resources going into from the government to R&D financed by government, the figure is not that different. In Switzerland, 0.75 of GDP, Czech Republic slightly lower, but it's proportionally similar. This doesn't include in the Czech Republic foreign funding public, especially from EU structural funds. If added, that would go up to 1%, so we would even higher than in Switzerland. So this is not really a matter of the amount of resources. This is a matter of how these resources are used. So it's not really a question about using more in the Czech Republic. It's more looking at how it's used. And again, the evaluation is the key and is the key weakness in the Czech context. So from this, I offer for debate three innovation policy dilemmas in the Czech Republic and questions that really need to be debated and are very seldom debated, in my view. First is whether the support for business innovation, whether it should be channels mainly through fiscal support to the business sector, through the cash grants, handing cash to firms, or whether the policy should focus more on what I would call framework conditions. So non-fiscal stimulus means that can include providing services, broker knowledge and information sharing in the system, that can involve creating a technology institute that would serve the industry, as in Switzerland, ETH, or Fraunhofer in Germany, of course. We have examples like that. One crazy idea from crazy academic, we are handing, it depends on the year, but it's a rank of billions Czech crowns for the cash grants, 5, 6, 7, 8 per year. What if we use this money and create technology, public technology institute, Czech Fraunhofer, for 5 billion Czech crowns annually? Wouldn't that be a big jolt in the system? The Swiss way. I'm not saying that we should do it, but that would be the Swiss way of promoting business innovation. It's difficult to do both, right? I mean, the public budget is limited. We cannot just add another 5 billion. But, well, there's a Swiss way. And, of course, I would add here also equity funding. So, for example, the public-private seed fund for venture capital that, fortunately, the Minister of Industry didn't manage to launch in the previous program period. That would be another idea, because that's not handing the cash. That the government can actually cash on this money later by itself. And, of course, people. We heard that ETH is training people for industry. And that's all, that's often forgotten, that that's one of the main channels of technology transfer. So cash is fine, but there are many other instruments. And the Czech system is very much focused on the cash part and underestimating the role of the other non-fiscal stimulus. Another policy dilemma is whether the support should be focused on upgrading of the existing incumbent activities and firms, or whether the policy should focus on entry of new innovation activities. I intentionally don't say just innovative startups, new firms. This can also involve major radical renewing of existing enterprises we have seen in history. It's rare, but it cannot be excluded. Nokia producing wood and then phones. That can happen, but mainly I mean here new innovative startups. As we have seen in Switzerland, much of the technology agency in Switzerland is focusing actually on the small new firms. They say small, but there are many of them are at the same time new. In the Czech Republic, again, the dominant part of the budget that goes into technological upgrading of the incumbent firms. Of course, there is one simple reason. Those are firms with the strongest lobbyistic power, so they can really make their voice being heard loud. Those firms that do not exist yet, they will not lobby the government at this point. The question here is if we consider scenario that we actually succeed in catching up with Switzerland in 20, 30 years from now, what would be the champions of Czech industry? What would be the silverware, the main leading companies in 20, 30 years, which, if we actually catch up with Switzerland, would it be the existing firms that are upgraded, or would it be come from this domain, new firms that don't even exist yet, something that is cooking in some student in the Czech University of Technology now will be established in 3 years. My point is that, again, the policy is mainly here, the main weight, and we at least should not try to put too many obstacles into this domain and consider maybe use this driver of catching up and growth more intensely than we are doing right now. And third, and that's from a quite different area, it always strikes me when I come back from Scandinavia how human resources management in the Czech system is very different when it comes to researchers in the public sector. So one way is to have what we have, very much hierarchical, linear, lifelong academic careers. One starts with PhD, goes to postdoc, and then goes to docent and then professor, and basically starts 20 years old and leaves 70 years old and has no alternative. If he wants to pursue academic career, has to, you know, jump all the hoops and stay in the system. Well, that brings job security, of course, but it means incredible rigidity in the system. In Scandinavia, many other countries, Switzerland too, we'll probably confirm, the careers are much more flexible. Hiring is competitive. It's much more dynamic. Of course, it's much less popular among the academics. There are exceptions, but job security, everybody likes that, right? Here, horizontal mobility is much more intense. People leaving the system, the academic system, starting up company, spin-offs, entrepreneurship of scientists, that can happen here. It's very difficult and unlikely to happen here. If you build your career for 20 years, get the docent phase, then the risk of starting a company, leaving the academia, the company failing in 2 years, and you have to start basically from scratch somewhere else, that's just not worth the risk in most cases. So this is just not happening in a system like that. So again, we are losing with this system some part engine of catching up in technology by this design. Another aspect is internationalization of research. Of course, there are many people local who start in the pipeline, and then, you know, when it gets to the docent professor level, it's very difficult, you know, to hire professors if the system is not open. Here, competitive, flexible hiring. In Switzerland, I believe 50% of PhDs are foreign, and in academia, in public sector, it's about 40% are foreigners. In the Czech Republic, it's 10%, and half of them are Slovaks. So, in terms of brain gain, this is very unfortunate, adverse position with this linear career path system. I know that my colleagues in academia might hate me for saying that, but competition is good for you. I survived the Norwegian system, I survived the Swedish system, and it really works. It will help technological catching up of the Czech economy if we look at that. And a final point is that there's EU policy, clear recommendations. It's called Charter and Code for strategy for researchers. And in Switzerland, most of universities and research institutes actually sign up for that rules that are in this spirit. In Czech Republic, there are just few, two or three. So Switzerland is not a member of EU, but follows those recommendations. Czech Republic stays much behind. So it's not only the cash for business, but academia has a job to do in this respect. Thank you. That's all.
Thank you, Martin, very much for your interesting presentation. Thank you, the audience, for keeping attention on very rich presentations. I can conclude that the food for thought was really served. Before I call for a short break, let me inform that we will follow by a panel discussion. So the task for the panelists is to think about their reflections they will present here each for about 5 minutes. You should focus on what was presented and tell us what you find most important. And the audience can start thinking very freely about any question they have about motivated by the presentation. So we'll meet here in about 10 minutes for the panel discussion. Thank you very much.